Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 2pm on Wednesday, April the 1st, these are our main stories. Research has backed the finding that a loss of taste and smell may be one of the first signs that a person has been infected with coronavirus. The health authorities in the Netherlands have invited thousands of people to take part in a controversial investigation into herd immunity. Millions of us are now having to use video calls to keep in touch, but how safe is one of the most popular ones?
Researchers have found that it doesn't have end-to-end encryption, as perhaps is suggested, that it sends information to Facebook about a person's Zoom habits, even if they haven't downloaded Facebook.
Also in this podcast,
they're just going for it. They're coming down, they're running down the streets, they're roaming around wildly, they're climbing onto stuff, they've been climbing onto people's houses.
While lots of us are staying at home and isolating, a group of animals in Wales definitely aren't. More evidence has emerged to indicate that loss of taste and smell may be an important symptom of coronavirus. A team at King's College London looked at responses from more than 400,000 people reporting suspected COVID-19 symptoms to an app. The researchers want to gather better information to help experts understand and fight the disease. Out of those who tested positive for the virus and used the app, almost 60% reported a loss of smell or taste. Professor Tim Spector is the lead researcher on the study.
We think it's an early warning of what's going on. Some people go on and develop the rest of the problems, but other people, for reasons probably we don't understand, but something to do with their immune system, just have this rather minor symptom and get over it after about a week. So we know so little about this virus, that's why we need to keep an open mind about how it presents.
Our health reporter Michelle Roberts has been taking a closer look at the evidence.
So the researchers have looked at people who've responded to an app on their phone. All of these people think they might have symptoms of coronavirus. So from the 400,000 that got in touch, they found that there were certain symptoms that seemed to be quite common. So around half said they had fatigue or tiredness. A third nearly had cough or shortness of breath. But a fifth seemed to be saying that they lost sense of taste or smell or both together. And this is something we've been hearing about anecdotally anyway. Obviously, the difficulty is not all of these people that have reported symptoms have been tested for coronavirus. So we don't know how many of those have actually got the infection. In this sample, there were 579 who'd actually got back a positive test result because they'd been able to get hold of the test. And among those, about three-fifths had reported loss of sense of smell or taste. So it's hinting that these could be other indicators that we can use to know if we might have been infected.
So with those symptoms that we do definitely know about, we're being told basically to self-isolate. Is there advice now for people losing their taste and sense of smell to do the same, or is it just not clear at this point?
So it's not clear. I mean, smell and taste might be another indicator, but we're not at the point where we can add it as a definite to the list of things to watch out for.
And as this is such a new virus, I imagine scientists and researchers across the world are just learning new things constantly.
They are. And I mean, it's important to do studies. It's difficult to do gold standard ones where you have people in a room and you test them and you give half something and half the other. But this sort of citizen science, if you like, where people respond to things via an app, could be really useful in tracking the spread of something that's quite hard to get a grip on because we haven't got enough tests to go around at the moment.
The figures continue to be grim. The number of infections from coronavirus in Spain has now passed 100,000, with more than 9,000 deaths. It's a similar picture in Italy. While official figures suggest the rate of new infections is slowing, the number of deaths recorded each day remains high. Almost 12,500 people have died. Among them are doctors. More than 60 have now died, with medical unions saying they lack the necessary necessary equipment to fight the outbreak. Our Rome correspondent, Mark Lowen, sent this report.
From the tip of northern Italy to the heel of the boot, they stopped to pay tribute. A minute's silence, mayors lowering flags to half-mast, usually to commemorate the world wars, but now to remember the fallen from this battle against coronavirus. Rome's mayor is Virginia Raggi.
It is a wound that unites the country and a pain that makes us a community. We have to come through it, so the sacrifice of those we've lost is not in vain. We have to make it for all those who are fighting to protect our health, risking their own and sometimes their lives.
Medical unions say the huge loss of doctors here, at least 66 since the outbreak began, shows a failure to protect those trying to cure it. Giovanni Leoni is from the National Federation of Doctors.
They worked without the right equipment, like proper masks, and they weren't given them. Not enough had been tested. We were completely unprepared. China showed us what we needed to do, and we didn't follow it. It's like sending soldiers to war empty-handed, unable to defend themselves. We could have avoided these deaths. Doctors paid for their commitment with their lives.
Who am I talking to? Christian is in the red?
Yeah.
So young, inventive Italians have stepped in. We reached Christian Fracassi and Alessandro Romaioli in northern Italy, whose company, Isinova, has made a valve through 3D printing that turns a sports shop's snorkeling mask into a ventilator mask.
That's the inlet with a pipe, of course.
With a hole for the oxygen tube and another through which the patient exhales. The blueprint has been downloaded for free a million times by hospitals in need across the world, a medical lifeline that makes Christian proud.
2 days ago, it was my birthday, and I received a message from Brazil in which a doctor says me that 100 people were breathing thanks to my idea, and I was very, very happy. I cannot receive a better present for my birthday.
Here in Rome's central Piazza Venezia, the huge Italian flags fly at half-mast from the altar of the fatherland, the enormous white shrine to the first king of a united Italy. This proud nation has overcome wars, occupation, fascism, but these 5 weeks have torn through Italy's heart. The flags fluttering here above the fountains are a symbol of grief for a country that needs to stop the dying, to feel that there's an end to this exhausting test of national unity. As the commemorative tribute ended, a police officer sang an operatic version of the national anthem, a call for solidarity. The infection rate is slowing here, the peak is maybe a few days away. But with this damage done to families, the economy, society, Italy could take a generation to recover.
The World Health Organization has been clear. The best way to stop COVID-19 is to find out how many people have it. But across the world, governments are being accused of not testing enough or not testing the right people. So what should they be doing? Here's Jonathan Savage.
The WHO sets the tone, and its Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus delivers the message, as he did loud and clear 2 weeks ago.
You cannot fight a fire blindfolded, and we cannot stop this pandemic if we don't know who is infected. We have a simple message for all countries. Test, test, test.
If you look at South Korea, you'll see why supporters of mass testing feel so strongly. After the first cases of the virus emerged there, they rolled out an enormous testing program, confirming every suspected case and testing everyone that person had been in contact with. It helped them isolate people who weren't showing symptoms but could still spread the disease. Testing also helps judge the scale of the infection. If you know that 10 people have died, it's important to know also if that's 10 out of 100 infected individuals or 10 out of 1,000. There are calls for health workers to be tested first, as an asymptomatic doctor going to work in a hospital is not what overstretched health systems need. Tests are done via a swab of a patient's throat, and more companies are coming forward to help countries meet testing targets. But those targets still aren't always being met. Here in the UK, the government has focused its efforts on building a national testing centre, which isn't yet fully operational. It's been criticised for not testing enough people. And determining those who have the disease isn't the only thing that can be done. You can also test for those who have recovered and may possess some immunity. David Heyman is a former head of the World Health Organization's Infectious Diseases Programme.
This will be very important in beginning to unlock various sectors. Suppose, for example, that it's found that students don't have a high level of antibody, then it would be absolutely important that they be a sector considered for unlocking sooner than other sectors which might have a great transmission pattern due to the antibodies found in the blood.
At the moment, there aren't enough testing kits of either type to meet demand, but as a weapon against COVID-19, it will become more common and more crucial.
In the Netherlands, the Public Health Institute has begun an investigation into herd immunity against coronavirus. 6,000 people have been invited to participate. So what does the study hope to find out? A question for our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan.
This is a rather controversial kind of concept, the idea of trying to allow the virus to spread in a controlled way through the least vulnerable people in society in order to try to create something that's called group or herd immunity to protect those who are most at risk, so the elderly. The study they have just launched here in the Netherlands involves 6,000 volunteers, and I should say they're volunteering to give their blood, not to get coronavirus. And the scientists will look at the antibodies because, of course, coronavirus produces antibodies, so they will measure the antibodies in the volunteer's blood and use that to work out how many people have actually been exposed to the virus, because we know some people actually have the virus without showing any symptoms at all. And then the next stage will be to look at how long the antibodies actually stay in the blood and the quality of those antibodies. In other words, to try to gauge whether it will mean that people can be immune if there is a second round of this infection.
And herd immunity, a lot of people are really anti it, a lot of people are really pro it. Are they hoping that they can create some kind of vaccine? What's the thoughts about it?
That's exactly right. And it's been explained quite clearly here in the Netherlands. It was also referred to in the UK. And it's controversial because it kind of suggests that you are, ethically, it's a difficult one to explain because it's suggesting that you are allowing a deadly virus to move through the population. Actually, the idea is, from the scientists, I've just been speaking to one from the Dutch Public Health Institute, actually, who said once you get 60% of the population infected, it means they think, and this is something that's also going to be tested in the study, those people will no longer be carriers. So in other words, people will be able to move around in society again in a normal kind of way without the risk of them infecting these people in the older age ranges who here in the Netherlands and elsewhere we are seeing are the most vulnerable to this virus.
Next, we're using them for work meetings, to catch up with friends and family. Even the British Prime Minister is chairing meetings on them. But just how safe are video call apps? The New York Attorney General has written to the owners of one of the most popular apps, Zoom, to question their security measures. Zoom has told us that it takes the privacy, security and trust of its users extremely seriously. I asked our technology correspondent, Jane Wakefield, what the concerns about Zoom were.
So, I mean, no app like this is entirely secure. And obviously, the security risks with anything that you download. And in the case of Zoom, there seem to be some specific kind of privacy issues. Researchers have found that it doesn't have end-to-end encryption, as perhaps is suggested, that it sends information to Facebook about a person's Zoom habits, even if they haven't downloaded Facebook. There's also worries about attendee tracking, which is something that the host of a Zoom meeting can do. And of course, we've seen recently these instances of Zoom bombing, where people who aren't invited to the meeting can come in and cause mischief and then sometimes start shouting abuse or streaming pornography in the middle of a meeting. So there are some sort of worrying issues around it. It also collects information about users, including their videos and transcripts and their notes, in order to sort of improve advertising.
And the owners of another app, House Party,
Party, which is incredibly popular. They've also had to defend themselves, haven't they?
Around the weekend, there were rumours that it was hacking into Spotify and various other digital accounts. And the implication was that it was some kind of rogue app that was breaking into your digital life. But actually, security experts have looked at this and said there's very little evidence that it's doing any of that. And in fact, its owner, Epic Games, which is a pretty big brand in itself, has now put out a $1 million bounty for anybody that can find evidence that this is a sort of organised smear campaign against it. These apps are being used by people. They're perhaps not quite understanding the safety precautions that they must take. And it actually, with Zoom, there are some very simple things that you can do to make sure that you're not Zoom bombed. For instance, you can not share links publicly. You can make sure that your meetings are password protected. You can set the screen sharing so that only the host can do that. There's lots of little measures that you can take. But of course, people in their sort of eagerness to engage with others, often being in quarantine and not being able to engage face to face, are turning to apps like these without necessarily understanding exactly how they make them secure.
Still to come, returning to work after COVID-19, but how safe is it? First, the sound of nightingales. But it seems our favourite songbirds may become a rarer sight because of climate change. Scientists fear they've developed smaller wingspans, which could make it more difficult for them to migrate between sub-Saharan Africa and Europe. Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, has the story.
Well, the nightingale, as you know, is a very popular bird throughout Europe and Asia, a very popular songbird. In fact, it can produce over 1,000 sounds, much more than many other birds. And it's a very small little bird, and it migrates every winter, goes from Europe down to sub-Saharan Africa, a very long journey, and its wings are pretty critical to that. Now, what scientists have discovered in Spain, where they've been monitoring the birds for about 20 years, is that as the impacts of climate change have taken hold there, as they've had longer, drier summers, the nightingales have responded by having smaller numbers of chicks, and also those chicks seem to have smaller wings. And the scientists say this is actually the bird doing a good thing, trying to evolve to deal with the conditions. But the problem for them is that those shorter wings are the wrong types of wings if you're going to be making a big journey. So they're worried about its impact on its ability to migrate in the future.
And is there anything that can be done, or is this the situation now?
I think it's unfortunately a situation that's not in their control. It's more about what are the conditions being set in the world in terms of climate change. They wonder if the birds might change their migration patterns. They might come from not travel so far, but there's no evidence of that yet. That might be one thing that might happen. But the bigger picture is, of course, that climate change is ongoing, and unless emissions of carbon dioxide are tackled, the problems for the nightingale and for all of us will continue.
That was Matt McGrath. Later in this podcast, how lockdowns around the world are seeing a rise in domestic violence. Countries around the world battling coronavirus are learning from those that have dealt with it before them. China, for now, appears to have got a grip on the virus and is harnessing the power of its mass surveillance and data collection. The use of mobile phone data has proven particularly effective, and some of the techniques are being copied by others, including Singapore, South Korea, Iran and Israel. While here in Britain, scientists are now advising the government to use a phone app that would alert people if they've recently been in contact with someone testing positive for the virus. Christopher Fraser led the study. Claire McDonnell asked him how it worked.
The idea is to take the basic principle of contact tracing. So contact tracing is a mainstay of infectious disease control. And the way it normally works is that you interview an individual and you ask them who they've contacted in the last 5 days, who they've spent time with, and then you try and find those people and you tell them to quarantine themselves when they're at risk. So what we did is we took that idea and we integrated it into a phone app concept where the phone itself records, identifies some anonymized identifiers of the people you've contacted. So your phone records whose other phones you've been close to. And then when you're diagnosed, then all of the other people are instantly notified that they're at risk and can self-isolate and quarantine.
Now, the reason this is very similar, I just wanted to ask you, is it that there was the app called Trace Together used in Singapore? They got the idea from China. Is it along similar lines?
was along very similar lines as the one in Singapore. Now, the one in Singapore, in China, there's a different system. So the inspiration that we got was based on the concept that there was an app that could indicate to you what level of risk you were at and to help you to self-isolate, to protect others and to protect the health system. So we a number of groups converged on the idea, including in Singapore, on the idea of this instant digital contact tracing. And what we've added really is also the epidemiological modeling, the understanding of the dynamics of spread to show why this is potentially so effective. That's because about half of the transmissions occur before somebody has symptoms. So we really found that there was no other way of getting ahead of the epidemic curve. So the alternative, really, to control the disease are mass lockdowns. So mass lockdowns are essentially quarantining the whole population. But through digital contact tracing, you can really minimize the number of people who are quarantined to those who've been immediately in contact with those who've been infected.
And just to be clear, would you activate this app? Would you log into it when you started to feel unwell, or would you have had to have a test? What's the sequence of events then that will make the data useful?
This is really the key point, is that it's to be effective, it needs to be adopted by a very large fraction of the population. The majority of the population needs to be using this. So there's a few challenges to this. You need widespread adoption. You need a system that people have confidence in, and you need a coordinated launch within a sort of national context such that the data are collected over a number of days before this tracing starts. So there needs to be a transition from a period where it's added in to other control measures, including social distancing.
From boredom to food shortages, billions of people around the world are currently experiencing a range of challenges that come with having to stay at home. But for victims of domestic violence, a lockdown is a chilling prospect. Merlin Thomas reports.
A quarter of the world now lives under lockdown, and people are forced to stay in their houses. But home isn't a safe place for many people. Campaigners and agencies warn that the coronavirus outbreak will lead to a domestic abuse pandemic, as vulnerable people are left with no choice but to live in close proximity to their abusers. Dubravka Szymonowicz, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, has urged governments to put alternative measures in place.
They need to continue with different measures to protect women and children against domestic violence, because on many occasions also shelters are shut down, courts are not working and so on. They need to see how to provide alternative safe places, how to increase possibilities for women to escape dangerous places.
In Hubei province in China, where the now global coronavirus outbreak began, domestic violence reports to police more than tripled in one county alone during the lockdown in February. And it's a pattern being repeated all over the world. From Australia to Brazil, France to India, associations that help victims of domestic violence have sounded the alarm. Governments are trying to think of innovative ways of helping the vulnerable in lockdown. France has announced that it will pay for up to 20,000 nights in hotel rooms for victims to escape abusive partners. In Spain, women can request what's been labelled a mask 19 in pharmacies, which will alert staff to contact the authorities. In the UK, you can call the traditional emergency number 999, wait for the handler to pick up, and make some kind of a cough or any sound at all, and press 55, which would then raise the alert. Angela Jofrida, the Rome correspondent for the British Guardian newspaper, explained how victims are calling for help in Italy.
What we have seen is quite a sharp decrease in the number of calls going to the National Domestic Violence Hotline. On the flip side of that, we're also seeing an increase in the number of messages that women are sending via SMS or online. So that's a sign, you know, that they're unable to make calls because they're trapped at home with a violent person, and they're also unable to leave the house.
But the executive director of UN Women, Pumzile Mlambo Ngunguka, told the BBC that it was impossible for women from lower socioeconomic backgrounds to report cases because they might live in one or two room homes with their abusers. As the virus takes thousands of victims across the globe, domestic violence could be the silent pandemic, the true scale of which we may not discover until it's too late. For too many.
Now, Sweden is almost alone in Europe in allowing life to go on much closer to normal. Pubs, bars, restaurants and schools are all still open. With a long-established culture of remote working and a high number of one-person households, you might think the risk of spreading COVID-19 is reduced. But the numbers dying are rising. Victoria Craig asked Andreas Hatzegiorgiou from the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce what he thinks of Sweden not having a lockdown.
The business community here in Sweden thinks that the policies implemented by the Swedish government are more sensible than in many other countries, taking small steps instead of going forward with a complete lockdown.
Have there been any changes to how people run their businesses in Sweden? Have there been any decreases in consumer spending? Because some data show mass transit rides have at least fallen since the start of the outbreak. So has that had a knock-on effect on business?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the effects here in Sweden are dramatic. The aviation industry is having a really, really difficult time. Hotels are basically empty. Factories have to close down. Having said this, the situation could be worse if the Swedish approach had been more similar to other countries with a complete lockdown.
So consumers are still going out to cafes and restaurants. They're still shopping, just maybe more social distancing happening in public.
Social distancing is not something that's really new for us. Social distancing is part of the Swedish cultural DNA. But places are still open for business compared to other countries.
And the case counts compared to other Nordic nations are higher. Is that a worry for business owners that you've been speaking to?
What the business community here thinks is that we should have a combined approach, minimizing the health effects and also minimizing the risk of mass unemployment.
So how are businesses doing that in practice? Are they limiting the number of people that can come in? Here, for example, in the UK, there's only a certain number of people who can go into a grocery store at a time. Are those the same measures that we're seeing in Sweden?
Yeah, similar measures. One advantage of Sweden in general is that we're very, very digitalized, which also limits the negative impacts now of the corona crisis.
Andreas Hatzegiorgiou, CEO of Stockholm Chamber of Commerce. Thank you.
Thank you.
A question many of us are asking is how safe is it for people to return to work after they've had coronavirus, especially those on the front line of the health service? Beth Timmons has this report.
Talk of returning to work might seem premature for Europe and the US, who are now entering the coronavirus's peak phase. But the first wave of convalescence is approaching. And for many of those, returning to work is a matter of urgency, as they are much in demand frontline healthcare workers who have now recovered from the virus. One of them is Dr. Mark Gallagher, a cardiologist at a major London teaching hospital, who told the BBC about his experience of being ill with the virus.
I stayed off for 2 weeks. The requirement is at least 1 week, but I certainly wasn't feeling anything near ready to come back after 1 week. After 2 weeks now, yes, just about. I might not be quite up to full strength, not perhaps as efficient as I would be normally.
While Dr. Gallagher is now back at work in the UK, in Italy it's policy to test 2 weeks after the onset of infection, before doctors return to service. So what does this mean in terms of those who have recovered, then going on to infect patients?
The evidence, of course, is very sparse because this is a new virus. We don't have a lot of evidence as to how long a person remains infected. We do know that the virus can be detected in the system, that a sensitive test can pick up the virus in a person often 3 weeks after the infection starts. What's less clear is whether that is a viable virus capable of causing infection in other people or just a trace of the nucleic acids of the virus. So I'm very careful this week to minimize patient contact and to wear protective equipment whenever I'm with patients or colleagues for their protection, on this occasion, not for mine.
The Italian guidelines, along with China's, would also have meant that Dr. Gallagher would only have been let back into work after 2 negative tests. But how infectious are we after recovering? One study following 4 medical professionals treated at a Wuhan hospital showed that traces of the virus could persist in the body for up to 2 weeks after symptoms had vanished. But as the patients were no longer coughing or sneezing, the potential for transmitting the virus was reduced. Another study from the Lancet Medical Journal revealed that the virus survived in a Chinese patient's respiratory tract for 37 days, longer than the average 24 days for those with critical disease status. More research is also needed to learn whether people can catch COVID-19 twice, after a woman from Osaka in Japan tested positive a second time. One reassuring tipping point to bear in mind is that around a month after China's initial outbreak, with strict containment measures in place, the number of recoveries began to outstrip the number of new cases. This is the point current containment measures are aiming to reach, as governments and companies around the world continue to encourage remote working, even among those of us feeling healthy.
And to end this podcast, something completely different from Wales. In the town of Llandudno, the streets are deserted, apart from a marauding herd of white mountain goats. Yes, you heard me right. The police have even been trying to chase them off. So what's going on? Rory Carson has been investigating.
That's the sound of a mountain goat. And if you listen really, really carefully, that's the sound of them nibbling on a hedge in the town of Llandudno, which has been taken over by the goats.
Well, the first thing I saw was them running down the street at about midnight, and it's not normal to see them this far into town. But yeah, there was just like a whole herd of them just running down the street, and then they found a load of bushes and decided that they needed a little bit of a midnight snack.
They're in my car park quite a lot. They're eating our bushes. I mean, I find them quite amusing. They're quite a highlight of the day, considering we can't go out anywhere. They're quite nice just to laugh at sort of thing in the streets, and you'll see them just walking around, you know, from bushes to bushes, finding the next bush to go and eat, really.
Every single person in Llandudno has a story about these goats. At the moment, they're roaming the town centre. They're on the hunt for the biggest and the juiciest bush around. But I want to know, who on earth owns these creatures?
They belong to the town. The goats have been here for, they were given to Queen Victoria as a gift. We absolutely love them here in Llandudno, at least most of us do. And they do bring a lot of visitors to the town.
The town owns them and the town pays to keep these goats fit and healthy. And as for their favourite pastime whenever they wander in, we all know what that is.
Oh, they're interested in helping themselves to people's plants, there's no doubt, and also grass and things. There's fresh food for them, so they like to do that. They love jumping on walls.
They're just going for it. They're coming down, they're running down the streets, they're roaming around wildly, they're climbing onto stuff. They've been climbing onto people's houses, pictures that I've seen. They've been climbing around people's gardens, stuff where they don't normally go.
OK, so no area is out of bounds for these super goats. But why have they decided to come down now? Here's one theory.
Mm-hmm. We used to see a lot of seagulls, because obviously the seagulls are quite known around here as well for eating everybody's food, because there's no people. The goats have thought, oh, it's our turn sort of thing to take over the town.
That was Rory Carson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.